In 1941, responding to the need for industrial labor to power the military through wartime, the federal government built a planned community called Abbotsford Homes in Northwest Philadelphia. Having appropriated the land from a wealthy estate, the government cleared 80 gardens from the site and erected low-rise structures with hundreds of apartment units. Now, over time, the Warfield economy and its needs petered out, and in 1953, Abbotsford Homes were turned over to the Philadelphia Housing Authority to turn them into low-income housing. It was one more step towards institutionalized racial segregation in the city, and as with most housing projects, the years brought decay and neglect, resulting in nearly half of the original structures being demolished, and much of the terraced landscaping that once distinguished the community swallowed up by disrepair. Today, Abbotsford Homes consists of 235 units, and is only one of 691 existing low-income housing apartment projects in the city of Philadelphia. In 1990, Sean Thomas was a 16-year-old living in Abbotsford Homes, and like a lot of 16-year-olds, he was getting into trouble he shouldn't have. On the night of Monday, November 12th, 1990, Sean was up to some mischief.
I was doing what bad people would do, because I was getting a lot of trouble back then. A lot of trouble. I just remember that night, I went downtown. I'll never go downtown, so I remember it like it was yesterday. Went down there, I think we were going to take a bike or something. The police came, I walked away. They was like, "No, you come here." They knocked me up. I'm like, "Oh, my God."
That's Sean Thomas today, describing that night. He had been admittedly attempting to steal a motorcycle and got caught while doing it around 11:30 p.m. that night. He was charged with theft by unlawful taking of movable property, which is a third-degree felony, and spent the next few hours being processed. You know, fingerprinted, photographed, paperwork. But he wasn't released after that. They kept him overnight and then turned him over to his mother, who arrived to pick him up a little after sunrise.
They called my mom. She came and got me. I never forget. She said, "Next time I ain't coming to get you." I said, "I ain't gonna be for next time." So she bought me something to eat at Wendy's. We went to court that day. They was talking about.
Can you tell me what time your mom came?
Mom came around 6:45, 7, 7:30, something like that.
So you have been there at night?
Yeah, I spent the night there. So when she came and got me, it wasn't no sense of going back home. Because we stayed sitting right there. We went up to Wawa's, we ate. We waited for the place to open. We went in there.
In case you didn't catch it, the "in there" Sean is referring to is called the Youth Study Center. Now, it sounds like a community library or a youth gathering place, like the Boys Club or something, but that's not at all what it is. According to a handbook by the Philadelphia Division of Juvenile Justice Services, the Youth Study Center is the city of Philadelphia's highest level of secure detention for youth between the ages of 13 and 18. The young people sent here have either been arrested by the Philadelphia Police Department and charged with an offense, or have been ordered here by a family court judge. There are two reasons that a judge orders youth be detained at the YSC. The judge has determined that the youth will be a risk to the community, or he or she feels that the youth may not appear at their scheduled court date. The Youth Study Center acts as an intake center for juveniles charged with crime. They have to show up, check in, and wait to see if the judge orders them detained or lets them go home. Sean has a real clear memory of that morning because when he was presented with a subpoena to appear for his next court date, he noticed his name was wrong on the document.
My sister came down. They sent my name on the subpoena. I said, "That's not my name." So he shut the door. They said, "Well, who is you?" I said, "I'm Sean Thomas," but that's Sean Thompson. And I told them how my name was spelled. They had it spelled S-H-A-W-N. I said, "That's not my name. My name's spelled S-H-A-U-R-N, and Thompson ain't my name." They said, "Well, who is this?" I said, "I don't know. I'm telling you who I am." So he figured it out. He scratched it out, made me sign my name. I said, "All right." He's like, you won't go home, but you got to appear in court. I said, all right.
Many years later, attorney Jim Fogorski interviewed Doris Williams, who worked at the Youth Study Center on that very morning. While she couldn't recall Sean specifically because, after all, she had processed thousands of youth offenders in all these years, she did help confirm that Sean was on time for the intake. Because according to Williams, if an offender failed to show up in the morning on time, she had two options. She could issue a bench warrant or she could continue his case until the next day. Now, neither of those things happened with Sean, so we know he's telling the truth about being there at the appointed time at 9 o'clock. Well, Sean was given his next court date for about a month later and released. He had gotten to the Youth Study Center at around 9 a.m. when it opened, and he finished up around 11. And in the 2 hours that he was at the Youth Study Center, about 4 miles away in Philadelphia, Domingo Martinez had visited the Mellon Bank, withdrawn $25,000 in cold hard cash for his business, and had been killed in broad daylight and left in the street by his attackers. Support for this podcast comes from ABC's highly anticipated new series, 10 Days in the Valley. What happens when fiction becomes all too real? Kyra Sedgwick returns to TV as Jane Sadler, a famous television writer and single mother whose life is turned upside down when her young daughter is kidnapped in the middle of the night. Just like the controversial TV cop drama she works on, everything is a mystery, everyone has a secret, and everybody close to her is a suspect. 10 Days in the Valley is a chilling, thrilling, and twisty whodunit that takes place over 10 episodes in 10 weeks. Entertainment Tonight calls it heart-stopping and pulse-pounding, and Esquire says it's the new fall show that you will be obsessed with. Also starring Erica Christensen and Malcolm Jamal Warner, don't miss it. 10 Days in the Valley premieres Sunday, October 1st at 10, 9 Central on ABC. If Sean Thomas was across town at the Youth Study Center at the time Martinez was murdered, the real questions here are how in the world did the police determine that he was a culprit, and how did the state convince a jury of it too? To understand that, we have to carefully examine how the police investigation unfolded. So let's quickly revisit what we went over last week, what the eyewitnesses to the murder, at least the ones we know about, said that they saw.
There were other witnesses who were driving by and didn't stop. They actually continued on. One of those witnesses named Ron Smith stopped a police officer about 6 or 7 blocks away and told her what he had seen. And then he left and went on his way, and they were able to track him down later. But two men came in later in the day. You know, they claimed that they were driving down the street as well, and they both saw a red and white car that did the murder. And they said a red and white car by itself, no other car involved, three men, staged an accident with this victim's car, and then drove in front of it and walked back and shot him through the windshield. They described the man as 6 feet to 6 feet one, a large man, brown complexion. I don't know if they actually said what he was wearing, but they both said that there was a red and white car with a paper tag in the rear window. All of the witnesses who described what kind of a car it was said it was either a Chevy Nova or a Buick Skylark, which is the same car. It's the actual same car. They're both GM products. They're identical.
Oh, okay.
Finally, about 2 weeks after the murder, police found Ron Smith, who had seen the murder and told the police officer on the day of the murder what he'd seen. And he was interviewed, and he told them that he saw a man being dragged out of a car. He didn't tell them much at the time. Well, he claimed he thought he told them more than that. And he said that there was no other car there and no other people that he saw involved, only the one car.
And then there was Garcia, who ended up contradicting the testimony, and yes, Alan Howard did come to trial and testify to the red and white vehicle he saw, by saying that she saw a totally different car.
Well, the police first spoke to a woman who saw the murder from about a block away, and she actually heard the accident. She didn't see it, and she looked up from her doorway where she was onto a hill where the murder happened, and she said she saw two gray cars. And She said three men got out of one of the cars and ran back to the victim. And she heard a gunshot. She didn't see anybody shot. She didn't see anybody with a gun. She was too far away. And then she saw everybody scatter. And the three men, or, you know, two of the three men jumped back into one car. One man jumped into the victim's car, and all the cars took off. So the flash information went over that there was a gray Chevy Nova that were driven by three African-American men. That's what they were looking for on the day of the murder.
Garcia was, as Jim noted, the very first person the police spoke to, which is why the flash alert that went out immediately was based on what she reported and not what Smith, Howard, or King saw, even though they were the closest in proximity to the crime. I mean, think about it. They were not just right behind Martinez's car, they drove past his car. They saw the perp, they saw the car that actually blocked Martinez. But for some reason, the police went with Garcia's version and they stuck to it. But the problem was this. They apparently weren't able to immediately find any suspects or cars that matched Garcia's description, but what they did get was a lead from a police informant. 39 District Officer Valerie Watson thought maybe one of her go-to Abbotsford Homes informants, a woman by the name of Almarine Coleman, might have some insight. And she did.
There was an informant in Abbotsford Homes who was a woman who knew the police officers. I'm not sure if she was an actual documented informant, but she knew the police and she was, in the past, had fed them information before.
How do you know that?
She told me. She spoke to her about 3 years ago. And she said that all the information she gave the police were rumors that she heard. She had no firsthand knowledge of anything. But there was a rumor in the project that certain people from Abbotsford Homes had done this murder. And what she told me was the rumor she heard was that the Thompson brothers set it up and the Stallworth brothers did it. And she didn't know Sean Thomas as Sean Thomas. She knew them as Thompson. We think she actually had them mixed up with somebody else.
A rumor, however, is not evidence, and they certainly didn't have the evidence to arrest any of the Stallworths or the Thomas brothers for the crime. But it gave them reason enough to direct their focus on them. And by January or February of 1991, the official theory had evolved to it was all of these suspects, but with a blue car, not a gray car. Now, the informant told Jim she never said anything about the color of any car to her handler. But the reason the police likely shifted the story from a gray car to a blue car was this.
Sean Thomas had been seen driving a blue car earlier in 1990 by the police.
Tunnel vision much? It should sound familiar. We've seen this issue pop up in plenty of wrongful convictions. The police decide on their man, then they find a way to get him, instead of letting actual evidence lead them to the right suspects. Now, as we explored in our Freddie Gray series, certain neighborhoods are heavily policed in this country, and I'll let you guess which ones. Abbotsford's Homes and the surrounding area was no different than many black urban neighborhoods in that police presence was ubiquitous. They knew the people who lived there and kept an eye on their quote usual suspects, for lack of a better term. In this case, they knew Sean. They knew his brother Mustafa. They even knew their father from before. So while they couldn't exactly find a connection between them and a gray car, the police got lucky that Sean had been seen driving around a blue car. In fact, in a statement given by Officer Valerie Watson, the same one who was the handler of the informant, the following was noted. On 2/15/93, Monday, I saw Sean Thomas in the Abbotsford Projects around 3200 McMichael Drive, and he was driving a gray-blue Dodge Dynasty 1993 with a New Jersey license plate on the rear bumper. I have known Sean and his father for 3 years. So, for the police, making the leap from a red and white car to a gray car would have been tough, but a gray car to a blue car, well, that's much more manageable and, hey, it's close enough. So now it came down to building the case against Sean and his brother, and they knew exactly where to start, with Nathaniel Stallworth.
Thank you. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your individual needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. And now it can make life easier for you too. You too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again.
What we know about Nathaniel Stallworth, also known as Stinky, is not very pleasant. A heroin addict, convicted rapist, and by all accounts not the brightest tool in the shed, he was already a known quantity to the police, and in 1992, he happened to come in very handy to the cops because he was already in prison.
The first witness who's actually brought in is in 1992, February 1992, it's Nathaniel Stallworth. And apparently the police have been trying to find anyone from Abbotsford Homes who would go on the record and tell them what they wanted to hear. Well, Nathaniel was the first one to do that. He claimed that he did that because the police promised him they'd let him go home and see his girlfriend have a baby. And he even said it on the record. So he was shown photographs. He told the police exactly what they apparently wanted to hear. And he identified certain people as being involved in the murder. He said Sean Thomas, Mustafa Thomas, and people he didn't know. And interestingly, one of the people he didn't know, he identified in the photograph as Reynard Hardy.
Now, Nathaniel never said he was actually present during the crime. In his official statement, he said, "The day before it happened, my cousin told me that they was planning to meet in the parking lot by Mustafa's house. My cousin asked if I wanted to go with them, and I said yeah, because I knew they was going to get a lot of money. Sean, my cousin, told me they had a mark. That meant that it was going to be easy, somebody that couldn't help themselves. The plan was to watch the man or the mark come from the bank and follow him in his car when he got out to rush him and take the money. The next morning, I got up and went to meet with them at about 8 a.m., but the two guys, whose names I don't know, was there, and I got bumped out of going. I was mad because I was broke, and I knew they were going to get paid. I stayed at my house that day and did some chores for my mother, and then I think it was around 2:30 in the afternoon, and I see the cars were back. I went over to Mustafa's house, and Mustafa's brother, Sean, was saying how crazy it was, and my cousin was saying that they had to hurry up and get to Jersey, and they was all changing clothes except the two guys I didn't know." So, as he's identifying people, he says there are two people he doesn't know. But then he recognizes a photo from the array the police showed him and points out a man as one of the two unknowns. The picture he identified was of a man who went by the alias Reynard Hardy, as well as the names John Johnson, Stephen Johnson, Lucius White, Robert Taylor, and Nasir. Now, this threw the cops off for a bit because while it was true that this man was from Abbotsford Homes, at the time Martinez was murdered, he wasn't even in the state. He was living in Ohio, a fugitive from Pennsylvania at the time of the murder, and had numerous arrests for dealing crack cocaine there. Well, the police couldn't move on Stinky's information because it just wasn't solid enough. So they brought in his cousin, John Stallworth, who he had identified, for questioning. Interestingly, according to the official reports, Nathaniel was questioned in February of 1992, but John wasn't questioned until October of that year. So why did it take so long to bring in a murder suspect for questioning? Because sometimes it doesn't make sense to do so until and unless you have just the right leverage.
Later on, they used a ruse to bring in John Stallworth. They had an arrest warrant from John from a few years before that I still can't understand how they got, because John had never been arrested in Philadelphia. He was a resident of Camden, New Jersey, and yet somehow he had been identified in a Philadelphia robbery in 1989 that had been dismissed because of lack of prosecution. They used that, you know, that arrest warrant to get a federal task force to arrest John in New Jersey.
And bring him here.
Bring him to Philadelphia. He was surrendered by a lawyer. The lawyer told them not to question John, and he left. And then they took him right to homicide and sat him in an interrogation room.
Leverage found and used, the cops now had John in their grip. And according to the official version of events, he immediately folded, admitting his involvement in the Martinez murder. In his confession, John said that he, his brother William, Sean Mustafa, that Nasir guy, and a man named Louis Gay committed the crime. The police already knew Nasir, aka Renard Hardy, was in Ohio at the time of the murder, so that part definitely wasn't true. And a second monkey wrench in their case was the identification of Louis Gay as the sixth perp. There was no way Gay could have been with them during the murder because, surprise, he was in prison at the time. John's confession was clearly untrue, at least parts of it, but that didn't stop the police.
Police knew that Louis Gay was in prison, or they knew shortly after that, but they charged John with the murder anyway, knowing that the confession was false. Didn't charge anybody else because they couldn't. They sought the death penalty against John. I guess they, you know, they told the prosecutor he, you know, totally confessed. Didn't tell the prosecutor that the, you know, the confession was false. And then they worked on John to change his story because they knew it was false.
I was skeptical about John's confession being completely false because, after all, he did implicate himself and his brother, even if he got some other details wrong for whatever reason. Maybe it was only four perps who committed the murder, but the police were demanding that he give up two more names, so he just made them up. Or maybe he was trying to protect two men and switched out Gay and Nasir for them. Who knows? Regardless, John himself was now in hot water. And thanks to him, so was his brother William. When William was brought in by the police, he didn't deliver the goods the way that John did. He actually told the police he had no information about the crime, no idea who was involved, and that he had nothing to do with it. Having said that, he did admit to being part of an Abbotsford Home group known as the G-Boys, which would rob people after they visited an ATM. They would keep an eye out for the right mark, let them get their cash out, follow them on foot, and strong-arm the money away. They didn't, however, use guns or bump cars. That just wasn't their MO. So while William admitted to his G-Boy activities, he rejected being part of the Martinez killing. And despite John and Nathaniel's statements to the police, William wasn't charged at that point. John, however, was in prison now, having been charged with the murder. After being held for 9 months, his story changed in July of 1993, and he produced confession number 2. The new confession was laid out in a question-answer format. Portions of it read like this. Question: what is it that you would like to change? Answer: that he wasn't there. Question: are you positive that Louis Gay was not there when Domingo Martinez was killed? Answer: yes. Question: how can you be so sure that he wasn't there? Answer: because I know that he was in jail at the time this happened. The status of John's statement was now this: that he, William, Sean, Mustafa, Nasir, and somebody known still as the friend of Mustafa had committed the crime with two cars, one gray and one blue. And if you're wondering how and why the police were okay with this story being so radically different than what they initially knew about the crime, which was it was one car with three perps, a car that was red and white that then turned to a gray car, and now they ended up with two cars and six perps, well, honestly, I don't know. But at the end of the day, that's the story they went with. John said that the blue car sideswiped Martinez while the gray one pulled up in front of it to block it, and that Mustafa was the shooter. The new statement, though, wasn't given without a concession. John was getting a deal, agreeing to testify against Mustafa and Sean in exchange for the lesser charge of third-degree murder. Now that he had a plea deal, it was his job to convince William to back him up. And that he did. police arrested Sean, Mustafa, and William based on John's new confession. Then they conveniently locked up the two stalwart brothers together and let John work on him. Both the police and John convinced William to recant his first statement, in which he said that he knew nothing, and confess. If he confessed, corroborated John, and agreed to testify against Sean and Mustafa, John would get to keep his plea deal. And if he didn't, they would bring back Murder One charges and seek the death penalty against his brother. So William gave a new statement in January of 1994 that mimicked his brother's statement and was allowed to plead to lesser charges in exchange. The first-degree murder case against Sean and Mustafa was now signed, sealed, and delivered to the DAs. But despite this, they maintained their innocence.
Audible is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks and other audio products. Here are some of the reasons why I think Audible is the best solution for digital audiobooks. Membership includes one free audiobook a month, exclusive sales of 30% off all regularly priced audiobooks, and unlimited access to the channel's content. Plus, there's free apps for iPhone, iPad, Android, and Windows Phone. And unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. Finally, there's the Great Listen Guarantee. You didn't like it? You can swap it. Now, luckily, this wasn't the case for me with my recent purchase. It was Ready Player One by Ernest Cline, as narrated by Will Wheaton. It's about a dystopian future in which the key to solving a contest is knowledge of 80s pop culture. If, like me, you love pop culture, you'll love this book. And now Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. You can download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed. That's audible.com/undisclosed and get started today.
Mustafa and Sean were tried together in December of 1994, but represented by different attorneys. Sean was represented by attorney Joseph Canuso, while Mustafa was represented by attorney Teresa Denny. The trial opened up with the prosecutor pulling a bit of a dirty move. Officer James Caldwell, who was one of the first responders in the crime scene when Martinez was killed, was put on the stand, and the prosecutor presented and entered into evidence 14 pictures. Pictures defense counsel had never seen, of a blue 1977 Chevy Caprice Classic, purporting the car to be the one used in the commission of the crime, and upon objection to defense counsel, submitting to the court that John and William Stallworth would be testifying to the identity of the car later in the trial. Officer Caldwell, who took the pictures, testified at length about them, as well as evidence related to the car. A broken taillight, a face mask from inside the car, a piece of chrome trim from the passenger side that had some, quote, blue-gray transfer paint, allegedly from hitting the victim's car. Now, both of the stalwarts also mentioned the blue car when they testified on the last day of the trial, but they weren't actually shown those 14 pictures in the courtroom. In fact, those pictures were never mentioned again, all during the trial. What did weirdly happen was after the stalwarts testified, the lead detective in the investigation, Paul Worrell, took the stand and testified to the following. He told the jury that at least two cars were brought in for this case and that the crime lab did a full lab workup on each. He said that those cars were released when testing showed that neither car was involved. And as Detective Worrell stayed on the stand, the prosecutor introduced two Polaroid photographs of a completely new blue car. Detective Worrell identified them and told the jury that John Stallworth had seen those Polaroids back in July of 93 when he confessed. And after that, neither the prosecutor or that detective ever referenced the 14 photographs they had earlier admitted at the trial. The photographs showing a car that apparently had some blue and gray transfer paint, remember. So Detective Worrell testified that these two pictures were shown to Don Stallworth, who told him back in 93 that it was the car used to commit the crime, and who also testified that Sean and Mustafa were sometimes seen in that car around Abbotsford's homes, Worrell said that he actually had no idea who that car belonged to. Now, if that sounds a little bit suspicious to you, it should. And we're going to circle back to this mystery next week. But Worrell went on to give other important testimony. The court ruled that he did not have to disclose where he got John Stallworth's name from, so no one got to hear about that informant. He testified that their investigation led them to learn of the G-Boys and Stallworth, and when Worrell and his partner, Detective Martin Devlin, questioned him, he confessed and named five co-conspirators. Worrell went on to testify about the investigation, saying him and Devlin attempted to identify and interview as many of the G-Boys as they could, and of course questioned the people that John had named, including William, who he said, quote, wanted to cooperate with the DA, but couldn't remember the murder the first time he was questioned. Which is, by the way, not at all what happened, and it's made clear from William's first statement. William also testified to this, that he had checked out whether Sean had an appearance at the Youth Study Center on the day of the murder, but he said that he was unable to verify that he was there, because while he never actually visited the study center, he went to the trouble of giving them a call, and strangely enough, the Youth Study Center had no record to show Sean was there that day. In fact, testified Worrell, the study center said that they had no documents pertaining to Sean at all. Except, moving forward in the trial, when it was time to present a defense, Joseph Canuso, Sean's attorney, presented exactly one witness in defense of him, a man named Brian Cohen, the Youth Study Center supervisor at the time of the trial, and he showed up with some documents. A copy of the juvenile petition that charged Sean with the theft, dated the day of the murder, and a copy of the subpoena that Sean had signed that told him to come back for the hearing on the theft about a month later. Cohen testified to the fact that Sean had an intake interview on the day in question, but he couldn't confirm what time he had come in, only that, quote, the J file, or the juvenile file, indicated that he had not been detained. He had been released after arrest and expected to come in on his own. He said that intake interviews went from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sean's attorney wasn't able to pin him down to testify that if someone scheduled to show up at 9 didn't show, what, if any, repercussions there would be. He just asked if someone showed up late, would they be penalized? Cohen said no, and attorney Canuso moved right along. A big mistake, because he missed the opportunity to show that Sean had to have shown up on time, given that his interview wasn't rescheduled and there wasn't a bench warrant arrest issued. The state countered Cohen's testimony in a rather devious way. On cross-examination, Cohen was asked the following. Now, do you have information or do you know, can you answer the question, as to the Sean Thomas who was arrested on November the 12th of 1990, is the same Sean Thomas who showed up the next day on November 13th, 1990, whatever time it was? Answer. There is no way for me to tell no. Can you answer the question as to whether or not the Sean Thomas you are referring to in those documents is anybody in this courtroom? Answer. No, I don't. In other words, the prosecutor was arguing that someone other than the Sean Thomas sitting in front of the jury at that time could have walked on into the intake interview and signed his name for him, which would, well, have been one whole nother level of conspiracy. The prosecutor also got Cohen to testify that the intake only took about 30 minutes. Defense counsel had opportunity to redirect the witness, but he declined. Another missed opportunity. In closing arguments, defense counsel was, at best, rambling. He brought up the Youth Study Center but spent a lot of time on issues less compelling, like inconsistencies in the Stallworth statements. Not that these aren't important points, but when it comes down to it, proving the Stallworths changed their statements doesn't necessarily prove your client is innocent. And by now, you should well know, innocent until proven guilty is not how the system works. Canuso's job was to prove his client's innocence, which is not an easy task in most cases. But in this one, it didn't have to be so difficult. In fact, it should have been the most important part of his client's defense. It should have been front and center, but it wasn't. And co-counsel, the attorney for Mustafa, didn't mention the alibi at all in her closing remarks. The jury, in fact, didn't dismiss the possibility that Sean was indeed in court at the time of the murder. They actually went so far during deliberations to request a sample of his handwriting to compare it to the signature on the subpoena from the intake proceeding that day. If they could have compared the signatures and found them to be the same or similar, the state's suggestion that the person who signed the subpoena on the day of the murder wasn't the Sean Thomas in the courtroom that day would have been severely challenged. But defense counsel didn't respond to the jury's request and failed to provide the jury with a sample signature. Defense counsel didn't do a lot of things. According to a brief filed in support of Sean's PCR appeal many, many years later, quote, "This case did not involve any run-of-the-mill alibi. The witnesses available to counsel and not called included sworn Philadelphia police officers, court personnel, defense attorneys, and a juvenile probation officer. Those witnesses would have proved to the jury beyond a doubt Mr. Thomas's innocence. This was not just a failure. It was a colossal injustice." The brief argues at length that Canuso could have interviewed and presented an entire slew of witnesses to confirm Sean's alibi. The officers who arrested and detained him, the intake officer Doris Williams, his mother Hazeline, who took him to the youth study center, his sister Elaine, who came to pick him up from the center, and his court-appointed attorney at the time, Carlin Saphir. But Canuso didn't even file a notice of alibi defense with the court. Despite so many avenues to firmly establish Sean's alibi, his attorney failed to do so. A colossal injustice, indeed. Sean and Mustafa were both convicted and given mandatory life without parole sentences. The maximum sentence possible. Though Sean was 16 at the time of the crime, a juvenile. And if the Stallworth and the state's case was to be believed, he wasn't even holding the gun. Sean Thomas did not stop fighting his conviction for the next 23 years. He reached out to anyone he could find to help locate all his criminal record files, including that J file, the juvenile file, that Canuso could have obtained but failed to for years. He even wrote to the FBI hoping they could dig something up. He drafted and filed 3 pro se petitions himself without a lawyer.
How do you keep, like, for years and years and years, keep fighting? You wrote to the Inch Project, you reached out to the FBI. What did you think the FBI was looking for?
They're going to help me on some type with that.
How are they going to help you?
They
find your file.
Files or something. I asked for my police report. I petitioned the court about that. I petitioned the court about the law book because I wanted to see myself.
How did you find the copy of that subpoena? Did you always have that with you?
No, I think I had the
Did you give it to me?
Or did I?
They actually found it in Sean's juvenile file in court that existed at the time. That was his defense attorney and the DA who found that.
So when you filed your pro se motions in prison, I mean, you actually drafted those yourself?
Yeah, I had help from an older brother that was with me, but most of the stuff I did myself. Like, I didn't want nobody doing something for me, and then they get transferred, and I didn't know how to do it. So I had to learn the language. Couldn't play basketball like I wanted to. It wasn't important to. I said, if I don't get this life sentence off me, I'm going to have enough time to play basketball in jail.
Sean skipped playing basketball in prison so he could give his appeals his full attention. And when, in 2009, the very first Innocence Project was established in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, he was immediately on it. And so was Jim Figorski, who signed up to volunteer and help the Innocence Project in any way that he could. And one of the first letters he opened from inmates across the state asking for help was Sean's.
You got a letter, you reviewed a letter that Sean sent in.
Yes.
As a part of the initial slew of letters that the Innocence Project got. And what was it about his letter that struck you?
It had a ring of truth to it, because what Sean said happened to him the night before the murder is exactly what would have happened to him. He said that he was arrested and that he was processed in the 9th District, which is where he would have been processed, and that he had to make an appearance the morning of the murder at the Youth Study Center. And if what he was saying was true, that's exactly where he should have been. And I decided to take a look at that and see if I could verify his information. And I did. Everything that he said, you know, was true. And every place I looked, all it did was show me more evidence that Sean was telling the truth.
For the next 8 years, Jim worked with others at the Innocence Project to fight to prove Sean's innocence. On May 23rd, 2017, Sean Thomas walked out of prison a free man. No plea deal taken and no retrial. The road to this astonishing outcome was long and hard. And in those years, the things the Innocence Project uncovered about what really happened in Sean's case would leave them astonished and horrified.
He and several other people known as the G-Boys, who were in Abbotsford Homes, would follow people from a bank. They would watch them make a withdrawal. They'd follow them out of the bank, and they would do what they called a takedown. They would do a strong-arm robbery. They would walk up and threaten a guy or hit him and take the money from him. But they didn't use guns, and they didn't bump cars. And what she expected to hear, I don't want to say it for her, but I think what she expected to hear was, because of what he had said in his letter, that Sean Thomas was wrongly convicted, that he was going to say, look, I was there. They made me say Sean was there, but he wasn't. But what he actually said was, I don't know what happened because I wasn't there. And it sort of stunned everybody who heard it, myself that later that day, because then we didn't know what we had. I mean, how is it possible that none of these people did this murder? And he said, I don't know.
Next time on Undisclosed. A very big thank you to everyone who has made this show and this series possible, starting with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Thank you guys for everything you do and for working with us on this case. Thank you to our amazing producer, Mithil Thelhan, for keeping it all together. Thank you to Baluki for our original and this new logo. Thanks to our fantastic sponsors who make it possible for us to come back week after week with new episodes for you guys. Thanks to all of you listeners for your continued support. Lots of gratitude to audio producer extraordinaire Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and also the host of the fantastic podcast Crime Writers On. Please do follow us on social media. You'll find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. The handle is @UndisclosedPod. And don't forget to tweet your questions at us. Every week, John Cryer will be back to host our addendum. Very excited about that. Thank you to John for doing that again for us. But make sure you use the hashtag UDAddendum so we can find your questions. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Undisclosed.